Today's podcast is sponsored by Zencastr. I use Zencastr to record the Tally Room podcast, and it's an invaluable tool. I record pretty much every episode of this show remotely, with my guests joining me from wherever they happen to be. Zencastr allows us to record with high-quality sound, even if the internet connection isn't the best. It records a high-quality version on the local desktop and then uploads it when the internet connection allows, meaning that the audio the listeners hear is usually better than what I can hear when I'm recording. It also allows for recording video. I use it to be able to view my guests, but you can also record video in 1080p. It's super easy to use Zencastr. I set up a link for a recording and send it to my guests, and we're getting started in minutes. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use my code TALLYROOM, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting needs. It's time to share your story. Welcome to the Tally Room Podcast. I'm Ben Rowie. Wake up and smell the chaos. Tasmania has voted and elected a new, larger parliament, a complex, hung parliament, where it looks like the Liberal Party will be in government, but it won't be an easy time for them to stay in government. My guest today is Tasmanian cephalologist Kevin Bonham. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Ben.
Thanks for coming back on. So Saturday's election result was about as inconclusive as you can get. While there's still a number of seats not quite resolved, most things are clear. The crossbench will be a record size, possibly as many as 10 members of the crossbench. Both major parties are a long way from a majority. The Liberal Party appears to have fallen 3 seats short of a majority, while Labor has fallen 6 to 8 seats short. Kevin, how did the result compare to the polls?
Well, the polls did reasonably well. The swing against the Liberals was exactly what the polls expected. Now, I should say that the polls, there were quite a few of them, but they were all at least 2 weeks old by election day, so there was a bit of a question mark there. But the Liberals ended up about what was expected. The Greens ended up about what was expected. The main differences were that Labor did about 4 points better than the polls, so towards the top end of the polls, and the Lambie network did worse across the board. And independents did worse. On my seat-by-seat polling aggregate, the 2 seats where independents did worse were Clark and Lyons. And Lyons being an interesting one because that was where John Tucker was thought to be a possible threat.
There was a big swing against the Liberal Party. We're looking at about 12%, I think, last time I checked. Small swings to Labor and the Greens. Like you said, Tucker and Alexander did quite poorly. You know, the Lambie vote was roughly where you would expect them to do based on their performance in federal elections, right? And then on top of that, there was a big field of candidates. A lot of candidates ran, a lot of independents. Most of those independents flopped. You were mentioning on your blog post the other day about how tealism, like the concept of teals having an impact, really has completely failed to have an impact in the Tassie election. Claire Glade Wright, who ran in Franklin, didn't perform particularly well, didn't really make much of an impact. What do you think was going on there?
The candidates who were sort of running as a community independent style campaign, in most cases, totally flopped. Some of them got reasonable numbers of votes, but generally the independents who did best were either well-established independents who have been in Parliament before, or in some cases independents running on specific issues. But the sort of attempt to create a teal-style movement around Voices for Tasmania ended up endorsing a number of candidates who got something like 100 votes each. It just seems that there is no demand for this product down here, and that the reason there is no demand for it is probably that on the Australian mainland, it's been mainly driven by seats where you need to find someone who isn't a Labor or Green candidate who can beat a Liberal in a single member seat. Now, in Tasmania, there's actually no point in that. You can vote for Labor or Greens anywhere in the state and your vote can be effective and useful. It's not the case where you need to find someone who's not a Liberal.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's this misunderstanding of where the teals came from, you know, like, it wasn't necessarily that a majority of people in those electorates wanted to vote for someone of that particular narrow niche. It was that that narrow niche turned a losing Labor-Greens block into a winning majority. And when you have proper PR, like, you don't need to do that. You can just vote for the candidates you most like, you know, unless you're voting for a tiny little party that doesn't have a lot of support. The substantial groups get seats, you know, that this parliament's going to have four parties with multiple seats, and those were really the main parties that attracted votes in the election. You know, I think it's going to look reasonably proportional when the final results are in.
I should say that while, you know, sort of we use the term teals for some of these people, and generally the term teals isn't accepted down here for independents. They like to say that teals is a pejorative and they're not teals and they're something else. But all the same, whatever it is, there doesn't seem to be an appetite for this sort of movement. The only two independents who look like being elected at the moment are Christy Johnston, who is a former Glenorchy mayor, and David O'Byrne, who is a Labour Party disposal.
There was a big decline. One of the statistics I'm always interested in is the total vote for the major parties. Because historically, of course, you would have these swings back and forth, a major party would do worse, would do better. But in the past, you would have expected if there was a 12% swing against the Liberal Party, that that would go to the Labour Party and you'd see Labour get a big boost. And one of the things that's been really interesting is you've had that big decline in the Liberal vote and very little of it has gone to Labour. So the last time I checked the numbers, in 2018, 83% of the vote was cast for either Labour or Liberal. And at this election, it's about 66%. So that's about a 17% decline over two election cycles. The reality is kind of like you get a hung parliament because, you know, a major party just can't win a majority or even close to a majority. They probably don't need 50% to win a majority of seats, but you would at least need something in the high 40s. And when a major party is polling, you know, in the mid to high 30s, they're not going to win a majority. This is not going to happen.
The Liberals got 37 and they probably need about 45, maybe 44 for a majority. I'll have a better estimate once all the numbers are counted. It's a bigger problem for Labour, which has its primary seemingly jammed below 30, couldn't get it above 30 at any stage during the term in polling. How are they going to get to a situation where they can find a route to government in a 35-seat parliament that does not go through the Greens, except for waiting for some election where the Liberals have a catastrophic failure again, as has happened sometime in the past?
Let's go through the seat totals. At the moment, it looks like 15 Liberals, 10 Labour with their trailing in two other seats, so that could bring them up to 12, and four or five Greens, two to three, Jackie Lambie, and then you've got Christy Johnston and David O'Byrne. So on my count, at the moment, it looks like Labour has an outside chance of defeating the Lambie candidate in Lyons, and they also have an outside chance of defeating the second Greens candidate, Helen Burnett, in Clarke. Is that kind of your take? Have I missed any seats that, at least on a partisan basis, are not clear?
The seat that is most unclear on a partisan basis is the last seat in Lyons between Labour and the Lambie network. They're very close together on the quota total. Labour is more exposed to leakage because of Rebecca White's surplus and the way votes are spread out in their ticket. The question there is, will the Lambie candidates, as they are excluded, leak much more than the Labour candidates in terms of proportional leakage rates? That could be a hazard for them. So that one's quite interesting. The Clarke one, I was having a detailed look at it, and it's really hard to see after the votes that went in yesterday. It's now really hard to see how Labour prevent the Greens from getting two in Clarke. Lyons is the one in serious doubt. So we're looking at either 11 Labour and two Lambie, or 10 Labour and 3 Lambie. That's the main one that we're looking at the moment.
Okay, so that creates two scenarios for the Parliament. Either Liberal plus Lambie is a majority, and in that scenario also Labour plus Greens plus Lambie would be a majority. Alternatively, if Lambie loses that third seat to Labour, obviously Labour plus Greens plus Lambie is still a majority. Liberal plus Lambie now needs one extra seat, one of the independents. So Liberal plus Lambie plus Johnston would be a majority. And then on the other side, Labour and the Greens would then hold 16 seats. So they could theoretically get to a majority with the two independents. So those are the numbers. Before we get into who actually wants to govern, in the scenario where Lambie only gets two elected, what's the Liberal relationship with Christy Johnston? Like, is that kind of a situation where you can see that working out okay for them?
Christy Johnston in the Parliament has frequently voted with the Greens. but she hasn't given strong indications of who she wants to support in the case that it matters. But as we'll discuss later, it's likely to become irrelevant anyway because Labor doesn't seem to be interested in forming government.
Well, let's talk about that now. So on the night, Jeremy Rockliffe gives his speech, and it's very much a claiming victory speech. And I was asked about it when I was on the radio, and I was like, well, this feels like a political statement. He's not making a statement of fact. He's making a claim. He's trying to assert himself. And then when Rebecca White came out, her speech was very much conciliatory. This is a new era. We need to learn to work with everyone and work with the parliament that we've been given and that kind of thing. But then the next morning, we've heard some kind of conflicting stories, but generally stories saying that Labor has conceded that they can't form government, maybe they don't want to form government, that they consider it's the Liberals' turn to try to form government first. A few different flavours on that theme of basically it's up to the Liberals to form government now. What's your take on that whole back and forth that we've had over the last couple of days?
There are conflicting stories from yesterday in terms of what's actually been decided within Labor. And one of the problems here is that Labor's communications about the matter have been terrible. So a report appeared in multiple media outlets saying that Labor's administrative committee, which is actually an acting administrative committee, had made a decision that they would categorise this election result as a loss and not seek to form government, which would also automatically mean a spill of the leadership. And under party rules, they have a rule where Labor can't actually form a minority government without consulting with the admin committee. And this is sort of not too clear, but I think consulting is meant to imply have the agreement of. Separately, there's been various comments from Rebecca White that are sort of all about conventions and saying, you know, sort of like, oh, we recognise that the Premier should be given first go and something like this. Now, none of this means the slightest thing if it was actually the will of the Parliament to vote the Premier out. You know, he could get a Robin Gray situation where he insists on going back to the Parliament to test his numbers and then gets immediately brought down. So if Labor has taken that decision, they really need to communicate it more clearly and say, yes, this is it. We've decided that we're not going to form government here.
So from a constitutional perspective, Jeremy Rockliffe is the Premier until he's not the Premier, right? And he will face the Parliament. At the moment, it sounds like he will be in a position where he will be the government until there's a vote of no confidence. Whether he then decides to come to any kind of arrangements or simple things with any of the crossbench to increase his stability is one thing. If we don't really know yet, is Labor saying we're going to prevent a vote of no confidence? Because, of course, if Labor doesn't vote no confidence, then the Liberal government will be able to continue. Or are they simply saying we're going to let this government fail, but we're not going to actively set it up? Are we going to, you know, maybe set them up to potentially lead to another election in the near future? I think there's probably a theory within the Labor Party that allowing Rockliffe to govern and letting him fail in what is a difficult situation is preferable and hopefully would allow Labor to then come back and, if not win a majority, at least form a stronger minority government. And then I've also heard that part of this is about the dynamic of having a leadership change. There's a bunch of people in the Labor Party who would like a new leader and they don't want to wait. And if this process was considered to be still open to the possibility that Rebecca White could become the Premier, they can't replace her with someone else. And I think particularly if they're looking towards another election that, let's just say, won't be 4 years away, will be sooner than that, I can see why they're like, let's get a new leader in now and get that person ready.
Labor has this membership-based and delegate-based election system for leaders if there's a contested ballot. We don't yet know if there will be a contested ballot, but it can take a while. And also, if Labor was still in the mix for forming minority government, if they were still considering it, then it could, in theory, take months to even determine that they were in a position to do that based on what went on between the government and the crossbenchers after the Parliament was back in operation. Parliament's not expected to sit until, I think, May. It's still a way off. And, yeah, they could be in a caretaker situation for quite a while. The situation with Rockliffe is, yes, he is the Premier until he resigns, or is brought down by a motion of no confidence. He is entitled to meet the parliament irrespective of what the other crossbenchers want. But it looks likely that he is going to try to negotiate something like a confidence and supply agreement or something like that with enough crossbenchers for that not to be a problem. It will depend on who gets elected for the Lambie network, because at this stage, one of the candidates has a reasonable lead in one electorate, but we don't really know how many they've got and we don't know who they are. There's very close races between their candidates, and some of their candidates are pretty scruffy around the edges, so we could get some interesting outcomes there. But it looks like, particularly also listening to Jackie Lambie today, it looks like her will is that we put all this stuff that happened in the campaign behind us and we work for stability, which presumably means some kind of support to the Liberal Party, because there's no other way you're going to get it.
So I was going to ask you next, actually, about this element of Herr Clark where you have the intra-party competition. There's quite a few seats where we know that a party has won a seat, but we don't know who has won that seat individually. There's a number of seats where we're not quite certain about who the Liberal is that's going to get elected. And in most of those, the sitting incumbent is leading, but there's a non-incumbent not that far behind. And I mean, in Franklin, there's two incumbents. One of them has probably won the third Liberal seat and the other one has lost. But the most interesting ones are these Lambie contests, because in some of them, it looks like it's basically a dead heat, which, you know, logically makes sense if you think about if you're a voter who doesn't have any preference between the candidates of your party, you just donkey vote down the ticket 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or at least 1, 2, 3 in the case of the Lambie ticket. And none of these candidates had a particularly high individual profile. They didn't have a lead candidate the way the Greens do. And so you do sometimes see this in other ways. You see it, for example, amongst the non-lead Greens candidates in Franklin. They're all very, very close together. And the Robson rotation system kind of scatters those votes around and effectively then means that the tiebreaker is the votes cast for an individual candidate. And in the case of the Lambie network, it doesn't look like there are many of those votes. So they're not really there to break those ties. And so even if we become confident in the next day or two that the Lambie network is going to hold the sole balance of power, it seems quite hard to negotiate with that network until you actually know who has been elected.
Yes, the most surprising one for me with the Lambie network is Lyons, where the two candidates, Andrew Jenner, who's a former Tory mayor from the UK, and Troy Fitzner, who was their candidate for Lyons in the federal election and did extremely well, are neck and neck. And I would have thought that Fitzner would have outpolled Jenner easily. And I'm surprised that they're on about the same vote. And there's a similar situation in Braddon where Miriam Beswick, who was probably the lower profile and less promoted of their three candidates, is currently in the lead. So there does seem to have been a lot of linear voting, I suspect, in the Lambie voter base. And also the who are these people factor with the Lambie candidates may be one reason why they haven't quite matched their polling. Another reason may be simply that they did have a tail end of the campaign where the Liberals were attacking them quite heavily over them not having any policies.
And of course, there is a history in this country of minor political parties, particularly on the right, struggling to hold themselves together once people get elected, particularly candidates who don't have a high profile, who haven't been heard of before. You look at One Nation in 1998, and frankly, the Palmer United Party when Jackie Lambie was first elected too. It seems quite plausible that these members will want to have their own views and express them in their own ways, may not agree with each other and may not agree with what Senator Lambie thinks. And so we're looking at them as a block right now, and I think probably it's fair to treat them as that until things change, but they are probably much less likely to be coherent than, say, the four or five Greens.
Yes, and this is a case where, unlike most of these other populist party cases, this is a case where you've got new MPs who are thrown straight into the parliament in a position of great power. And it's going to be fascinating, depending on which ones they get up. In most cases, we know very little about these people, and what we do know is interesting. So it's going to be, it could be a rough ride. And yeah, there is a possibility that the Lambie candidates are going to act very independently once they've been in the parliament for a while, and numbers that we're adding up with Liberal plus Lambie and so on may become less simple. It may be that it is quite a difficult parliament for the Liberal Party to control.
How long do you think it will take for the count to conclude? Because, as I said, there's a bunch of these seats. Even if in the next day or two things become clear and we go, you know what, that seat in Lyons is called and we know the partisan count of the parliament, there's quite a few seats where we don't know who the individual person will be. How long will the count take? And then can you run us through how the actual distribution of preferences will work in Tasmania when we will get that information?
So the timetable for the count is that there'll be significant votes added. These are absent votes and postals, which should go into the count this Thursday, next Monday, next Tuesday. Next Tuesday is the cutoff for postal votes to be received. And once we get to that point, then the distributions of preferences can start. And they're expected to finish around the Saturday after Easter, assuming that there is not any need for a recount. And they have left a few days in the schedule before declaring them in case there is a need for a recount, which is a rare event.
So a lot of these PR counts we have in Australia, ballot papers are data entered and then there's a button pushing. There's a moment where, you know, the button gets pushed and then 20 minutes later we know who's won and then later on we get the distribution preferences. That's not how it works in Tassie, is it?
No, in Tasmania it's not a manual throw. I don't know why it hasn't gone over to data entry, because it has gone over to data entry for our council elections, or at least nearly all of them. But anyway, that hasn't happened yet at state level. And so the count will start with surpluses for candidates who are over quota. There are four seats that have one candidate over quota and one seat where nobody does. Their excess preferences are distributed. What this actually involves is all of their votes are passed on to other candidates, but they're now at a reduced value. And then once that's done, if you don't have any other surpluses, you start from the bottom and you're just cutting candidates out, cutting candidates out, cutting candidates out, and redistributing their preferences until somebody gets over quota. When they get over quota, you distribute a surplus, and then you go back to the bottom once you've got nobody else over quota and keep going. And as it goes on, the exclusions get larger and they take longer, and eventually you end up with seven winners, the last couple of which may or may not actually get quota.
So we'll be getting updates as we go, and probably seats will get called as we get closer, right, when we see how many votes get leaked and all that kind of thing?
Yes, particularly as the preference distribution goes on, it often becomes clearer during that preference distribution at some point that somebody's going to win or that somebody's going to lose, and so you know, have a trickle of seats being called and firmed up. But we will probably get some that are going to keep going for a while. Some of these Lambie contests are going to be extremely close and are going to wait at least until the third Lambie candidate is excluded before you know which one of the other two has any kind of lead. And it wouldn't be too surprising if we get some seats decided by very small numbers of votes this election.
Now, there's a Tasmanian upper house election coming down the pipe in early May. There was two electorates that were due to be up for election. Prosser, where I'd already anticipated how it was going to be a first-term Liberal MLC who had faced down a Labor opponent in the last election, and it was probably the most classic Labor versus Liberal of all the Tasmanian upper house elections. But Jane Howlett, she quit her seat and was elected to the lower house on Saturday. And then we have the seat of Hobart and inner city Hobart, where Rob Valentine, a centre-left independent, has retired. And then we've got Elwick, which is immediately north of Hobart, where Josh Willey, who is a Labor MLC, has quit 2 years early and has also been elected to the lower house. So we've got these three contests. What do you think are you expecting from those contests, and do you think that's going to have any impact on the dynamic of this very fluid hung parliament and possibly shaky minority government?
These are going to be very important Legislative Council contests because of the dynamics of the Legislative Council, where it's roughly half independents. And we have been seeing votes in this parliament where you get the major parties lining up on one side and all of the independents from across the political spectrum on the other. So this is not just about the overall political balance of the upper house, but also about the parties versus independents balance of the upper house, and even about also the possibility of a Green getting elected in the upper house. So all of these contests, I think, are very important. And the election will have unsettled the dynamics of them. We see now that with Josh Willey vacating Elwick, the Glenorchy Mayor, Bec Thomas, has immediately put her hand up to run as an independent and obviously a major contender. For Prosser, I would expect that the Liberals may decide to recycle one of their state election candidates. I can't see them not contesting that seat because they really need that seat, and they did win it last time.
Hobart is fascinating as well, where you've got Cassie O'Connor, the former Tasmanian Greens leader, partner of Federal Greens Senator, running Charlie Burton, who is an independent endorsed by Andrew Wilkie, who's the Federal MP for the area. So you've got this kind of intra-left fight. I don't know if Labor's going to jump into the fight too, but it doesn't seem to be any doubt that that seat will elect someone of the left. But is it a Green? Is it an independent? Is it Labor? That's going to be really interesting. Having two seats that share a substantial border, that doesn't really happen in Tassie LC elections, right? They tend to spread them around on this six-year cycle. Usually the seats are in all different parts of the state, but because Elwick has been vacated early, you've got, I don't know if there's going to be a bunch of dual booths, which is not really a thing normally in Tassie LC elections, but having these two seats next to each other might change that dynamic that often has always been so advantageous to independents, that they are kind of treated as these individual cases rather than part of a broader political contest.
The TAC had big problems in 2021 with the Legislative Council elections and the state election being held on the same day, and with voters ending up only voting in one, not the other one. And that was because booth voting in the Legislative Council was restricted to within the electorate. So you had problems with booths just outside the electorate. You couldn't actually vote for the Legislative Council there. So the Elwick-Hobart boundary line will make for some logistic issues, I think.
Okay, last question. How long do you think this parliament's going to last? How long before Tassie has another election? It's due in March 2028. So that's it, right? The election will be in March 2028?
So at the tally room on the night, there were Liberal Party members gathering around yelling, four more years. And it was only because that I was working for the Mercury that I resisted the temptation to yell out, don't you mean three? Because the last two governments haven't gone full term, and those actually started as majority governments and both lost their majorities. So how long this one is going to go, anyone's guess. There is a bit of a debate. People are actually pushing for fixed terms, and it's not uncommon in these situations for crossbenchers to try to get fixed terms enacted so that the government can't easily run off to an election and dump them. So it will be interesting to see. I think the turbulence within the Liberal Party is going to be something to watch for in this term. They would have to think that this is not a very convincing result, and there will be people on the right of the party who will be sharpening their knives even if they're not doing it publicly. So I think it could be a bumpy ride.
I mean, you've got Michael Ferguson, who's a bit more of a conservative. You've got Erica Betts coming into parliament. Your mate Julie Slattin looks like she'll be the last Liberal knocked out in Bass.
She's a possible. Slattin's a possible. There are some reasons to think that she might get some bundles of preferences coming her way. We'll see how it goes as to whether she gets in or not.
And you'd have to think if there's a casual vacancy at some point, she would be a contender.
Particularly if for some reason Ferguson decided to resign, that will be on a plate for her, I would suspect. They tended to be prominent in very similar areas of the electorate. Launceston has a big Bible Belt area where both of them had a lot of signs. I was there during the campaign.
Probably worth clarifying that Julie Slattin is not actually Kevin's mate.
This was a controversial Liberal pre-selection involving a candidate who had strongly criticised the government over vaccine mandates and who generally associates with what we might call the minor right in Australia. Her views on many things fit more within the sort of the Babbé-Rennick One Nation sort of spectrum.
So that's about it for this episode of the Tally Room podcast. Thank you, Kevin, for joining me.
Very welcome.
So, Kevin, people will be able to follow your analysis of the late vote count and the distribution of preferences, I assume?
On my website, kevinbonham.blogspot.com, and I have a tally board page there and links to analysis of each individual electorate.
It's very useful reading. So you can find this podcast on your podcast app of choice. If you like the show, please consider rating or reviewing us on iTunes. You can follow the Tally Room on Mastodon at tallyroomandmastodon.au or like us on Facebook. This podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support of our donors on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/tallyroom. Information about this podcast is available at tallyroom.com.au, and you can email questions or feedback to thetallyroom@gmail.com. Thanks to Chris DeBro for writing the music you hear in this episode. Once again, thanks for listening.